From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Millions More movement on the 10th anniversary commemoration of the Million Man March is designed to mobilize our people, brown people, the Native Americans, and poor people to address the horrific condition of the poor in this nation.
10 years after the Million Man March, the Millions More movement is heading to Washington, D.C. This time around, the event is open to women and supported by a broad coalition of groups. We'll speak with Russell Simmons, founder of hip-hop label Def Jam Records, grassroots organizer Larry Hamm, and economist Julianne Malveaux. Then a speech by writer, preacher, and scholar Michael Eric Dyson.
White supremacy is the conscious or unconscious belief or the investment in the inherent superiority of some, while others are believed to be innately inferior.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It's emerged that President Bush's nationally televised video conference with U.S. troops in Tikrit, Iraq, on Thursday was scripted beforehand. The White House had painted the event as an impromptu conversation with the troops, but video from the satellite feed before the event gave lie to those claims. The 10 U.S. soldiers and one Iraqi were coached in their answers before the event by Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary Allison Barber. She stood at the White House podium, where Bush would later stand. She read part of his opening remarks and then proceeded to outline the questions Bush would ask. At times, she suggested phrasing for the soldiers' responses. Here are some of the coaching.
Captain Kennedy, if the question comes up about partnering, how often do we train with the Iraqi military? Who does he go to?
That's going to go to Captain Pratt.
Yeah. Good. And then if we're going to talk a little bit about the folks in Tikrit, in the hometown and how they're handling the political process, who are we going to give that to?
That's going to go to Captain Williams.
And then in the last 10 months, what kind of progress have we seen?
To Master Sergeant Lombardo.
But if he gives us a question that's not something that we've scripted, Captain Kennedy, you're going to have that mic, and that's your chance to impress us all.
Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary Allison Barber coaching soldiers before their video conference with President Bush. With the referendum on Iraq's constitution just a day away and President Bush's popularity plummeting, the White House clearly wanted the event to give the impression that the U.S. plan in Iraq is moving forward.
You defeat a backward, dark philosophy with one that's hopeful. And that hopeful philosophy is one based upon universal freedom. I'm very impressed that the Iraqi government has continued to work to have a constitution that attracts Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. They worked hard to get a constitution, and now the people of Iraq are going to get to vote once again on a constitution.
During the brief video conference, the handpicked soldiers appeared to fawn over the president. At one point, one told him, quote, "We began our fight against terrorism in the wake of 9/11, and we're proud to continue it here." But a telling moment came when Bush asked the soldiers to comment about their interactions with Iraqi civilians, and Captain David Williams could only cite a secondhand account.
I was with my Iraqi counterpart in Tikrit, the city of Tikrit, last week. And he was going around talking to the locals. And from what he told me that the locals told him, the Iraqi people are ready and eager to vote in this referendum.
The video conference was set in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, which Bush lightly acknowledged he could not safely visit. Interestingly, Tikrit was the backdrop for many of Saddam Hussein's propaganda videos. There was one Iraqi present for the video conference, Sergeant Major Akil, whose only role was to tell President Bush, quote, "I like you." When it emerged that the event was staged, reporters grilled White House spokesperson Scott McClellan, asking him directly about the coaching.
I'm sorry, sir, are you suggesting that what our troops were saying was not sincere, or that what they said was not their own thoughts?
I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just asking why it was necessary to coach them.
Well, in terms of the event earlier today, the event was set up to highlight an important milestone in Iraq's history and to give the president an opportunity to once again express our appreciation for all that our troops are doing when it comes to defending freedom and their courage and their sacrifice.
Meanwhile, during that same White House press briefing, Scott McClellan declared that veteran correspondent Helen Thomas opposes what he called the broader war on terrorism. His comment came in response to her critical questioning of Bush's Iraq policy. Eventually, ABC's Terry Moran jumped in defending Helen Thomas. Here's some of the exchange.
Well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter. Terry,
on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
And speak for her, which is odd.
I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns.
Scott McClellan at the White House press briefing addressing ABC's Terry Moran about Helen Thomas. Meanwhile, the latest poll on President Bush shows what some analysts are saying may turn out to be one of the biggest free falls in the history of presidential polling. According to a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Bush's job approval rating among African Americans has dropped to 2%. That drop is thought to be key in Bush's overall approval ratings falling to an all-time low of 39%. A few months after 9/11, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll found Bush's approval rating among blacks at 51%. As recently as 6 months ago, it was 19%. The latest numbers are attributed in part to the government's handling of Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. The poll also found just 29% of people think Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers is qualified to serve on the nation's highest court. The bloodletting near Chechnya continues. Early Friday morning, Russian special forces stormed a police station in southern Russia where 8 rebels were holding 5 hostages. Russian officials claim the hostages, including police officers, were freed and all 8 rebels were killed as they tried to flee in a van. This was the latest in a 24-hour string of bloody battles, and the death toll could top 100. On Thursday morning, large groups of gunmen assaulted government buildings, telecommunications facilities, and the airport in the city of Nalchik. Chechen rebels claim responsibility for the attacks. An anti-war British playwright has won the 2005 Nobel Prize for Literature. Harold Pinter is known for his activism and writing against the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. He's called British Prime Minister Tony Blair a, quote, deluded idiot, and President Bush a, quote, mass murderer. The U.S. has announced the creation of a new intelligence agency led by the CIA to coordinate all American overseas spying activities. The National Clandestine Service, or NCS, will oversee all human espionage operations, meaning spying by people rather than by technical means. The director of the new agency, whose identity will remain secret and is simply known as Jose, will report directly to the head of the CIA, Porter Goss. Florida Governor Jeb Bush this week promoted the judge that oversaw the recount of the disputed 2000 presidential election. Palm Beach County Judge Charles Burton was appointed by Bush to the 15th Judicial Circuit, one of 55 new judicial positions created in Florida during the 2005 legislative session. Vivian Jones Malone has died. She's best known for being one of 2 African-American students who challenged segregation in Alabama with their effort to enroll at the state university in 1963. The move led to then-Governor Wallace's infamous stand in defiance of orders to admit black students. Jones and James Hood, accompanied by a deputy U.S. Attorney General, enrolled after Governor Wallace finished his statement and left. Jones went on to become the first African-American to graduate from the University of Alabama. She died at the age of 63. Now to the continuing scandal over the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The New York Times reports the federal government has moved hundreds of thousands of evacuees from Hurricane Katrina into hotel rooms at a cost of about $11 million a night. This, the paper says, is part of the effort to meet President Bush's mid-October deadline to clear out shelters. The plan has drawn fire from local officials and some members of Congress. As we've reported on Democracy Now!, there are tens of thousands of livable vacant apartments in New Orleans that remain empty. To date, more than 22,000 people remain in shelters in 14 states. Hotel costs are expected to grow to as much as $425 million by October 24th. On average, the hotel rooms cost taxpayers $59 a night. Atlanta's Mayor Shirley Franklin said the plan is, quote, deplorable, disappointing, outrageous. The federal response has just been unacceptable. It's like talking to a brick wall, she said. Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts said, quote, the administration's policy is incoherent and socially seriously flawed. A new report by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch has found that in the United States, more than 2,200 children have been given life sentences without the possibility of parole. The report names Virginia, Louisiana, and Michigan as the most aggressive in imposing such sentences. The practice is outlawed in many countries and by international law under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Across the U.S., African-American youth were found to be 10 times more likely to receive life without parole than white youth. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. This weekend marks the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March, which was first conceived by Louis Farrakhan in 1995. That historic event brought hundreds of thousands of African-American men to Washington, D.C., and this weekend, the Millions More movement will commemorate that occasion. This time around, the event is open to women and is supported by a broad coalition of groups. The main event takes place at the National Mall on Saturday and will bring together social justice advocates, members of Congress, hip-hop artists, media pundits, academics, and business leaders.
The goal of the Millions More movement is to mobilize people to change policies that keep many African Americans in poverty. And the event has been shaping up as a forum for Black America to respond to the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. The day will begin at dawn with a public memorial service for those who died in the catastrophe. This is Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam and organizer of the first Million Man March.
We decided before Katrina that there is a disconnect between the learned scholarship of our people and the condition of the masses. So we felt that the Millions More movement should put a program in place that linked the skill and intelligence of the gifted members of our community so that we can lift our people from the condition that we are in.
Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. Filmmaker Spike Lee has also expressed his support for Saturday's march. His 1996 film Get on the Bus chronicled a group of men traveling from Los Angeles to Washington to attend the Million Man March. This is Spike Lee.
We've gone forward, we've gone backwards, but I still think that for me, that was a positive event. People might say, well, we're still where you are, when that whole thing started, but I think that many lives were affected forever. So if I believe that, then I believe it was a positive event.
That was filmmaker Spike Lee. We're joined right now by Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress, also chair of the New Jersey State Organizing Committee of the Millions More Movement, was sending more than 100 buses to Washington, D.C. tomorrow. We are also joined by Julianne Malveaux, who is an economist, author, and commentator. Larry Hamm, let's begin with you. What are the plans for the weekend?
Well, here in Jersey, we have right now close to 150 buses coming out of Jersey, primarily from the major urban areas. These buses have been organized by 16 local organizing committees in 16 major urban areas in the state. And most of the buses are full now. Many of our LOCs are trying to get more buses to go down. The buses will be leaving. Some of them will be leaving like 1 a.m. this morning. Some will be leaving at 3 a.m., others at 5 a.m., and so forth. And we hope to all be down in Washington, certainly as early as possible, probably around 10 a.m., and then we will stay on the mall. We're not going directly into Washington. We're going to take the metro line into Washington and then march over to the mall and join the rally there.
And Russell, I remember covering. Larry. I remember covering 10 years ago the Million Man March, and the size of the crowd, of course, became a huge dispute with the corporate media trying to downplay the numbers as well as officials in Washington. What do you expect the size of the mobilization this time compared to 10 years ago?
I think it's going to be very large. I think that there will be people there from all over the country. I think there'll be different responses from different parts of the country. I know here in Jersey, our response has been pretty consistent with what we had in 1995. Certainly more than 10,000, perhaps between 10 and 20,000 men came out of New Jersey for the 1995 event, and we expect an equal number of people to come this time, because the march is now open to a number of other constituencies.
In fact, as a result of the Millions Man March and that controversy, the Millions Man March sued the police in Washington for underestimating the march, showing that it was over a million people. And since that time, the police will not estimate marches. Julianne Malveaux, it's great to have you on. Last time, it was the Millions Man March. This time, it's millions more. Your response, are women being included?
Oh, absolutely, Amy. I am on the National Executive Committee and have been working closely with Minister Farrakhan and the others on the program committee to ensure a significant participation of women in the program. As you may recall, in 1995, I was very opposed to the march. I didn't think that the African-American community could be afford to be divided along gender lines. And I was privileged to just have a long conversation with the minister about that earlier this year and agreed to work with them. It's been quite a learning experience around issues of diversity in the African-American community, but I assure you that women's participation is there.
We're also joined on the phone now by Russell Simmons, founder of Def Jam Records, president of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, Russell, of course, there are some groups, the ADL, for instance, that recently blasted again African-American leaders for refusing to make clear their positions in terms of Louis Farrakhan, who is the chief convener of the march. And you responded recently in an open letter. Your thoughts on that, some of that criticism?
You know, I'm the chairman of the Foundation for Ethnic Understanding, and Rabbi Snyder is the president. And our job is to promote dialogue. There are not enough organizations that base their work on bringing ethnicities together. Usually it's one group defending themselves against all others. So what the ADL or even the NAACP or any of these organizations do, it can be very, very effective, and their intentions are always good. But sometimes a public dispute, like the one that Abe Foxman brought up, people misunderstand it. In other words, Abe Foxman, I know, you know, since I'm friends with all the heads of the World Jewish Congress and, you know, and a lot of the other people who are perceived as powerful in the Jewish community, they don't have the same view as Abe Foxman. African Americans, I don't think Abe Foxman has met an African American leader that he liked anyway, ever. I think he's attacked every single leader we've had. So I think it's better not to, you know, to put too much weight on his words. He's already proven a number of times that his credibility, I think the whole Jewish community, not the whole, I mean, lots of members of the Jewish community and their press have attacked him and his intentions. And lots of times he gets paid by figuring out who the boogeyman is. That's what his job is. You know, we also just conducted a survey on race, and we found that the foundation did. And the survey, the results are disturbing regarding Americans and their divisions regarding race ideas. But we found that the black community and Jewish community were more similar than any other two groups in our survey. And that results will come out in the New York Times. And it's just an interesting point. And I think when Abe Foxman gives us false information regarding the relationship between blacks and Jews, it polarizes those who are separate, you know, even further. So what we don't want to do is feed into negativity and then make that negativity grow.
Julianne Malveaux.
If I could jump in here. You know, I got two of these Abe Foxman letters. That man has absolutely no moral authority to speak to African-American people. When you look at his letters, you want to ask, well, what has he done for African-American people lately? I didn't see a Foxman responding to Bill Bennett suggesting that there should be genocide in the black community, that all black babies should be aborted. He has literally no moral authority and has become a divergent.
But he doesn't speak for Jewish people. That's a very important point as well. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
He doesn't. While he does not speak for Jewish people, he sits on top of a major organization. And what he also does is, I was at the press conference yesterday that Minister Farrakhan had at the press club, and literally the Foxman letter was the basis of two or three questions. So he keeps up a lot of junk. What's going on here right now is that you have people who are mobilizing because we all believe we have nationalists there, liberals. Along political lines, we have people, we have whites who are going to be there, Latinos, Native people. It's a broad-based coalition around mobilizing because our country is sick. I mean, it's the only way you can say it. When you come out of Katrina and you find an administration that will cap wages for poor people but not cap profits for Halliburton, this becomes the issue. If you cannot see this sickness, this illness, this rot in the way that we are thinking and that we've allowed ourselves,
the distraction,
not only as black people but also as Americans, drift since 1995, which was a moment of hope at some point. But we have drifted into, $300 and how many billion spent in Iraq, 2,000-plus lives lost between Iraq and Afghanistan. Katrina blew the window off the notion there was a level playing field. And then this brother who was just beaten by the police, if there was no other reason for this mobilization, look at a 64-year-old school teacher having his eye socket broken by six police officers. So Foxman is not even a footnote.
Julianne Malveau, Russell Simmons, and Larry Hamm. We have to break for a second, and we're going to come back to you. We are speaking with Julianne Malveau, economist, also on the board of the Millions More March that is going to take place in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. Russell Simmons, founder of Def Jam Records, president of Hip Hop Summit Action Network, and Larry Hamm, chair of People's Organization for Progress in New Jersey. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
It's time for us to face the truth and level with each other. It's time for us to face the fact that every brother ain't a brother. There are some who say to the world at large, I'm no color, I'm just a man. And there are some who say to the folks of town that black power is not their plan. But through it all, we kid ourselves and fool one another by failing to see the simple fact that every brother ain't a brother. I mean, a brother wants his people to have the things they need to survive. And a brother doesn't destroy his brother. He fights to keep him alive. A brother doesn't live off other brothers. He makes it on his own. And a brother wouldn't refuse a brother if the other really needed a loan. But you think about what brotherhood means, and then let's level with each other. I mean, the truth is the light, but it's a dark fact that every brother ain't a brother. Is the cat a brother who shoots a brother and thinks that makes him bad? Is the cat a brother who...
Gary Bird, Every Brother Ain't a Brother, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodwin, Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress in New Jersey. They're sending over 130 buses to Washington for the Millions More March tomorrow. Russell Simmons, founder of Def Jam Records, president of Hip Hop Summit Action Network, and Julianne Malveau, economist, author, and commentator. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Larry, throughout the 1990s, there was enormous emphasis on the drop in the crime rate and major social changes that were occurring. And most of the changes were ascribed to governmental policies. Very little attention was paid to the possibility that the original 1995 march had an amazing impact at the grassroots level in terms of how people redirected their efforts at community levels to take back their communities and change things. Your thoughts on this emphasis that's always the government and law enforcement that makes progress and change and not the people themselves?
Well, I definitely disagree with that. I think the Million Man March of 1995 had a tremendous impact on our community. One of the clear evidences of this is that African-American African-American men in particular and African-Americans in general increased their voting numbers significantly, both relatively and absolutely, after the Million Man March in 1995. There was, for a brief period, a decline in the crime rate. There was an increase in adoption of black children. There were many, many effects. And beside the broad social impact the march had, I think the most important thing was the individual transformative impact it had on many of the men's consciousness. And many of those local organizing committees that came out of the Million Man March in 1995 continued to this day. The Camden Local Organizing Committee in New Jersey, the Montclair Local Organizing Committee, the Jersey City Local Organizing Committee, right here in New Jersey. They never stopped. They never disbanded. And they kept going and kept involving and organizing in the community. So I think it had a major impact. But I want to say this, too. Rather than concentrating on people who are making these criticisms about the Millions More movement, we should really urge people to come out on Saturday. This is an opportunity for us to make a strong statement for social, economic, and racial justice in this country. The strongest possible statement we could make would be to have hundreds of thousands of people out there in Washington. So I urge everybody that can hear this program to get on a bus, find out where there's a bus, and get on it.
Julianne Malveau, quick question, reading the Washington Blade, where you are, Washington, D.C. It's a piece by Elizabeth Weil Greenberg, and says, just days before the commemoration of the Million Man March this weekend in Washington, black gay activists said they were confused about the status of a pledge by Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan to include a gay speaker at the rally, with some activists threatening to boycott the event. Farrakhan requested a last-minute meeting with members of the National Black Justice Coalition. During that meeting, Farrakhan assured them a person who identifies as gay and who's a member of the NBJC would be invited to speak at the rally. It's this according to H. Alexander Robinson, the executive director of the group. He said, it was pretty amazing. I went into this effort with some level of skepticism with our history of us being excluded. Said the NBJC is still seeking full participation in the Millions More movement. Your response?
Well, Minister Farrakhan did meet with the gay community, I believe, on Wednesday. He and Reverend Willie Wilson, who the gay community apparently has been very disturbed by, did have a meeting. And my understanding is that there has been a slot offered. We have not had final details on that. But I know that all along, Minister Farrakhan has said that he wanted this to be inclusive. When I met with him back in February, we talked at length. Obviously, there were some, wounds among feminists, especially about the 95 march, and many of those have been dealt with, and we have sisters from a broad array involved, and so I don't think there was ever any issue of exclusion. But one of the things that we've clearly learned in this process is while we can come together as African-American people, there are significant disagreements among us, and so we're juggling the issue of advancing the cause of our people, including our people, and then looking at some of the micro issues or other issues where there are disagreements. The meeting, I believe, I was told by Minister Farrakhan, was very productive and a lot of issues were put on the table.
And Russell Simmons, the involvement of the hip-hop community and musicians and other entertainers is quite breathtaking in terms of the numbers of people that are scheduled or are supporting the march and are going to be there. Your thoughts are you've been very active in the whole issue of getting more hip-hop stars involved directly in social causes.
Well, first let me say the minister has been a great inspiration to a lot of the members of the hip-hop community for some time. In fact, he spoke in 2001 at our first hip-hop summit, and the summit was to discuss the power of hip-hop and how we could use it as a transforming cultural phenomena. You know, and we got from him such an inspiring speech, and we made so many commitments, for each individual commitments, that we formed the Hip-Hop Summit Action Network. And his inspiration has been a great support system for us throughout. So the hip-hop community, as you probably all know by now, is the most important cultural, powerful cultural phenomena that America has seen ever. The jazz, the blues, the rock and roll, they were great movements, but as lifestyle movements and as transforming movements and cultural and what they've done for race relations and what we've done to have people all over the world recognize the voice of people who come out of a lot of struggle, a lot of poverty, a lot of ignorance is the basis for a lot of this dialogue, this poetry, this expression of a lot of people for a lot of people who would be voiceless. So the hip-hop community, the best brand-building community in this country, has a huge voice. If they say the Phantom Rolls Royce is cool, then it is. They say a Frank Mueller watch is okay, then it is. Coca-Cola's good, it's good. Not Pepsi's good. So if they say something that's inspired by the minister or by any spiritual teacher, that it's uplifting to people of all races and ethnic, religious and all. See, this is the best melting pot, the base that we've ever had in America, hip-hop. The hip-hop community is multiracial, multi-religious, but all singly cultural. So when they say things, it matters. When they, like 50 Cent said, change the drug law, then the governor changed it after 30 years. When Puffy came out and said, put some money in the education budget, the mayor put $150 million in the budget. Because when their voice comes out, they promote a lot of dialogue. A lot of times politicians can talk all day, but they can have an agenda, and they can be sincere and hardworking towards achieving that agenda. But the people are not listening. But when a music artist, or especially a rap artist, or one of these poets, get behind an idea, and then the rest of the hip-hop community gets behind the idea, there's no stopping it. So we have that power, and the idea is to get more people to inspire them to use that power. The summit is based on getting artists to use their celebrity to uplift their community.
I wanted to ask Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress about the issue of police brutality. This happening, though planned well before, after the beating of the 64-year-old African-American retired school teacher in New Orleans walking in the French Quarter, Robert Davis. Larry, you have dealt for years with the issue of police brutality. How central is this going to be? Not to mention the whole response to Hurricane Katrina in this march this weekend.
I'm glad you asked that question, Amy, because it is at the core of the issues that are propelling this march at this time. Let me just give you one example. When Minister Farrakhan came to Newark for the leadership meeting that was held there, I had made a request to him to meet with the mothers of sons who had been killed just here in New Jersey as a result of police brutality. Not only did Minister Farrakhan meet with them, he embraced them, he introduced them to all the leaders that were gathered at that meeting, and he made a suggestion, not a suggestion, I guess it was a kind of directive for us that are doing the work here on the ground. He wanted us to bring the mothers of the victims of police brutality, the mothers of the victims of street violence, and the mothers who have lost sons and daughters in the war in Iraq. He wanted us to bring them. He wanted them to bring poster-sized pictures of their children, and they were going to stand with him at the march on Saturday, at the rally on Saturday, tomorrow in Washington, D.C. So this is very central. And what happened to that brother in Louisiana was an outrage, but it happens every day. Amadou Diallo is all over this country. I mean, we had Earl Faison here in New Jersey. We're bringing the mothers of Rashaan Fuquan Moore, who was killed by Newark police in January, and the mother of Richard Guy, who was shot by Newark police, along with Fuquan Moore. We're bringing them down on our bus, along with the family of Earl Faison and other victims of police brutality.
Larry Hamm, Russell Simmons, and Julianne Mulvaux, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Larry Hamm of People's Organization for Progress, Russell Simmons, Def Jam Records, and Julianne Mulvaux, economist, author, and commentator. When we come back from our break, we're going to go to Michael Eric Dyson, one of the people who will be at the march, giving a speech recently in Washington, D.C. on the issues we're addressing right now. Stay with us.
The dark brown shades of my skin, only add color to my tears. Oh, oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, oh, oh. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord.
Syl Johnson, Is It Because I'm Black? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. One of the people participating in Saturday's event is Michael Eric Dyson, professor, author, cultural critic, and Baptist minister. His latest book is entitled, Is Bill Cosby Right? Professor Dyson spoke a few weeks ago at the first annual Unvarnished Truth Awards in Washington, D.C., organized by the Pacifica Washington, D.C. Bureau. This is what Michael Eric Dyson had to say.
White supremacy is the conscious or unconscious belief or the investment in the inherent superiority of some, while others are believed to be innately inferior. And it doesn't demand the individual participation of the singular bigot. It is a machine operating in perpetuity because it doesn't demand that somebody be in place driving. That's the vicious ingenuity of white supremacy. It has become institutional. And when white supremacy becomes institutional, it begins to harm the very people who are not simply outside of it because of their race. It begins to harm the folk who look like the folk who want to be in charge. Martin Luther King Jr. understood this. Malcolm X understood this. James Baldwin really understood this. And so much of my life has been trying to lay bare the presuppositions of white supremacy because they have damaged the very people who would allegedly and ostensibly benefit from some of that madness. Martin Luther King Jr., once in a jail, said to his jailer, "You are white and poor. You will never benefit from Jim Crow. You will never be able, except psychologically, to derive benefit from your white skin," what we now know as white skin privilege, what Du Bois in 1935 in his magisterial tome, Black Reconstruction, called the psychic wages of whiteness. King said, "You will never be able to derive benefit as a result of that. You are more like me than you are like them." And so when we think about warring against white supremacy in American society, it is so seductive to believe and invest in the mythology of superiority, especially among white ethnic brothers and sisters who, having been closed out of so much in American society, hold fast to that lie, hold fast to that myth, hold fast to that illusion because they have been so disenfranchised otherwise that they have to pump up the mythology of their inherent superiority. I've tried to fight against that, but I've also tried to fight against the occupied minds of people of color who pay uncritical deference to dominant culture, who without understanding they have internalized the vicious mythologies by which others have been made to live. James Baldwin, in reflecting on his own father, said in that poignant phrase, "He believed the lie." And so many of us have believed the lies. And I've tried to spend some of my career, some of my vocation, some of my time as a professor and preacher and social activist and paid pest trying to get at some of these ideologies that challenge the fundamental dignity of our common humanity. But it's also true that I have tried, as Dean Richards has so graciously said, I've tried to also ask the question within the community from which I emerge. Because if we take the notion from our Quaker brothers and sisters speaking truth to power, then it can't just be power outside the community, it's got to be power within that community. So for me, when I wrote a book about Bill Cosby, it's not that I'm trying to play hate on a great iconic figure, the American patriarch, but don't forget, he emerged simultaneously with Ronald Reagan in the early 80s when the Reagan junta and the Reaganomics, the Reagan regime came forth in 1980 and Cosby emerged in the shadow of Reagan. Reagan as the great grandfather, Cosby as the great patriarchal father. It was an achievement of sorts because for the first time, the imagination of the seminal father figure rested in black pigment. That was an achievement, to be sure. And yet, at the same time, the outlines of that patriarchy have been viciously revealed to be contradictory at their heart, because this great father of African American and indeed American society laid waste to the most vulnerable people in our culture. And so I chose to speak back to him to try to leverage whatever fame, authority, visibility, teaspoon of influence that I might be able to muster and to say those people who will never be able to talk back to you, Shaniqua and Taliqua, Muhammad and Shanane, those people who will never have a voice, those people who will never be able to stand up on their own two feet and to speak back to you because the global media landscape is so deep and your bully pulpit is so wide, it stretches across the world. How can they justly speak back to you? And so my work was just a small effort to express an outrage and an edifying resentment of the premise by which Mr. Cosby, or upon which Mr. Cosby rested. That is to say that poor black folk have let down black communities in the civil rights movement more broadly. Well, my Bible tells me to whom much has been given, much is required. And that means you don't start with the folk at the bottom, you got to start with the folk at the top. And whether you agreed with him or not, when you saw Mr. Harry Belafonte on Larry King's show, he was picking on somebody his own size when he went after Colin Powell. When he said that Colin Powell was a lapdog for the empire, when he said that Colin Powell was nothing more than a house Negro on a white plantation whose inability to tell the truth made him in league with the master. That's picking on somebody your own size. And then the difficult assignment of trying to parse in public the shades and nuances of racial discourse, even among enlightened liberals who reproduce the pathology of elite racism. What'd that mean? I'm saying that when Ms. Goodman so brilliantly called attention to how the Fourth Estate, as Sister Ibram spoke about it, holding the collective feet of the media to the fire, what I'm saying is that often it is not the bodies of those who are minority that cause the minds of those who are blessed to move into action. The difficult truth is that we live by narcissism, and when it happens to us, we better understand it. But by the same token, it does suggest that for so many years, those who have been dying before our eyes, those whose lives have been being poured out measure by measure, and it never affected us because it didn't happen to us. We never understood until the plight became personal. And I am not suggesting by any measure that most of us are not moved by having personal experience catapult us into politics. That's the beautiful story of Sister Sheehan. is that because of her particular loss, she began to understand the broader implications. But travel with me now to imagine that so many of the mothers have lost their sons without so much of a peep by a dominant media that refuses to acknowledge the nature of the loss. Come with me as we tour the inner city and the barrio and the Native Indigenous Peoples Reservation. Come with me through the post-industrial urban collapse of mothers who have long since surrendered the ability to exercise and leverage authority over the lives of their children because the state has been in cahoots with an underground economy, expanding the possibility of a drug economy while the above ground economy takes the jobs away from their men and their mothers and their sisters. The state has conspired to do dastardly deeds and to do ultimate damage to vulnerable black and brown and yellow and red people without so much as a peep from a media that has been standing there agog, arms akimbo, wondering about the penetrating madness that these people must inevitably experience. If you ain't a white girl and you disappear, you ain't got much luck. If you a black mama, a black mama might not even had the possibility of being a martyr and a hero like Miss Sheehan, because they might have been disallowed to even get near the Bush compound and ranch, because they would be suspicious already. Thank God that Cindy Sheehan went undercover. Thank God she looked just like a feckless, harmless white woman who just was going to the ranch, who knew that she had a behemoth inside of her that was going to challenge the dominant society. But there are so many others who have the same impulse who will never be acknowledged, because they can't even get that far. And so my own truth-telling, as far as I'm able to muster up the courage to say what needs to be said, and that thing is on a continuum, because all of us are made cowards by the realization that ultimately we have never said everything we're supposed to say. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "I have said so poorly what I have seen so clearly." And that's the truth. We see it when we see the vicious forms of assault upon our women. The reason I wrote a book, Why I Love Black Women, I was just tired of these rappers talking about women in nasty and vicious ways, but they ain't started it. I knew that. I knew Snoop Dogg didn't start misogyny. I knew that Tupac Shakur didn't start sexism, and God knows that Dr. Dre didn't start patriarchy. Yet they extended it in vicious form within their own communities. They made vulnerable people more vulnerable. But at the same time, we know that traditions of misogyny and sexism and patriarchy are deep and are profound and as American as apple pie. And so we have to tell the truth, on the one hand, balancing our attempt to hold these young people accountable while acknowledging the degree to which these dominant institutions in America have done the same funky, foul, nefarious thing from the get-go. And so for me, it means telling that truth. That's why I'm with Brother Damu in support of my man Kanye West. I ain't saying he's a gold digger, but George Bush don't fool with no broke people. That's what Kanye was trying to say. Kanye said that George Bush doesn't care about black people. He wasn't talking about George Bush, the individual. He wasn't speaking about George Bush, the private citizen. He's speaking about George Bush, the face of the government. George Bush, the face of democracy. He's speaking about George Bush as the symbolic head of a nation that refuses to acknowledge the humanity of black people. And why is that so controversial? In a nation that has lynched and looted and rioted and castrated, looting in the face of white riots? When lynchings were attended by families in their Sunday best to see the sexual organs of black men stoked by the sexual jealousy that continues to roil beneath the collective unconscious of the American psyche. How can we be surprised by the statement of a young person that America doesn't care, in the form of George Bush, about black people when such rituals have never been consciously not only apologized for but engaged? And then beyond that, in a society that tells you through the poison of the media that you are not worth as much because your face will not be on television, you will not be heard as much on the radio, you will not appear in ads that celebrate the inherent beauty of American society. Is it any wonder that Kanye West distilled and condensed into an acceptable and understandable saying what so many millions of others have already felt and with greater analytical precision got down to? And so now we're going to be mad. We talk about these rappers talking about broads and behinds and boozing and bosoms. My God, we're sick and tired of this bling bling culture, and yet when one of them steps up, we are so cowardly that we can't even stand behind them. Our politicians start to making excuses, and they begin to have their statements die the death of a thousand qualifications. Well, it's not so much that, just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. You worried about whether you can get reelected. Why don't you stand up to begin with? Why don't you come in with an understanding that maybe you're going to be a one-term brother or a one-term sister because you are put there to represent the people. It said we the people, not we the Supreme Court, not we the Congress. It said we the people. Those profound words that were articulated by a mass of flawed but imaginative framers suggest to us that you and I are part of a democratic experiment that is made sharper and more luminous and incredibly lucid by the difficult work of struggle by the ordinary folk who never get the credit. And as I end and take my seat, that's why it's so important to link all this stuff going on. This war in Iraq has been terrible before it started. We've lost 2,000 lives. Iraqis have lost over 100,000. We speak about these babies that these poor black women have. Where are they? They're on the front line. We talk about a society where young people are throwaway, poor white people, poor Latino people, poor African American people. These are the people who bear the brunt of the responsibility of waging war by people who will never step on that ground. People who send them but who will never go. And so there's a relationship. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about it. Paul Robeson talked about it. Ella Baker understood it. Joanne Robinson imagined the day when we understood how fundamentally they were united. And what I beg all of my constituencies and what I beg as a part of a multiple kinship group, as the anthropologists call it, I beg every community to understand we in the same boat. You might be in the anti-war movement and speaking out tomorrow, but don't forget the folk in Katrina. That's the beauty of what Sister Goodman was talking about and Brother Damu was talking about, what Sister Shindy Sheehan understands. It ain't just there. It's not when those bodies die. And God bless them. It's not simply when white bodies perish and white girls disappear. It's also about the unheralded casualties of people who are yet on earth, and yet the lifeblood has been sucked by the vulture of American empire. And these people will never be spoken for because they are the walking wounded and the living dead. And so I beg of you that as
that those of us who are able to speak on behalf of the disenfranchised understand we're in the same boat. The anti-war movement has been generated by this fearless woman who has moved forward in the name of a sense of outrage at the libel and the mistelling of truth that has been put forth by this political ventriloquist whose strings are being pulled by corporate capitalism to make him say what he's saying. And at the same time, don't miss how it's operating down in Halliburton and down in New Orleans and Mississippi and in Alabama. These black people, you see, people say, well, it's not about race, it's about class. What you talking about? Race often is the language class speaks. Race makes class hurt more. See, even poor white brothers and sisters are not necessarily going to school in concentrated effects of poverty. Even some white brothers and sisters are able to escape their poverty making more money than some black people who have gone to college. But the reality is poor white folk got more in common with poor black folk and poor brown folk and poor yellow folk than they got in common with the white overseers and the black overrulers and the Latino sellouts who have abdicated their responsibility to represent the people. And so as I end, I beg you, please gird up your loins and tell the truth where you are. You see, in Palestine, and as the Palestinians were struggling for self-determination with their Israeli brothers and sisters, they both came to a common declaration. They said, we want the quiet miracle of a normal life. That's what I want for so many millions of people, both here in the country and around the globe. There are so many people who suffer, who don't have our education, they don't have our bank accounts, they don't have our sense of leisure and luxury. And if you and I can't see beyond our own myopic, narcissistic self-preoccupation to help somebody else, to open up our minds so we can open up our hearts, so we can open up our lives and God knows our pocketbooks, but it's more than the charity. People said in the Katrina, well, you see, and some of the right-wing conservatives said, well, the most people who were helping there were white folk trying to lift those helicopter things down to help those folk. Well, charity ain't justice. Charity is beautiful, but you ain't got to be charitable to me if I already got justice. If I already got a sense of participation, you ain't got to be charitable to me. Just treat me right every day. And as I end, that's why you and I are on the same ship. In fact, we travel in the same plane. You might be in first class eating filet mignon. I'm eating peanuts back in row 55. We on the same boat. Don't cut a hole in the boat to suck water out to sink the Titanic. And if you're in the plane, being in first class ain't gonna stop you from going down with the rest of us. When there's turbulence everywhere. Everybody be shaking. And if that plane goes down, you might die first in first class. Yes, some of us are in first class, but the plane is in trouble. What will you do to speak to the pilot, to tell the pilot, to tell the control center that we got to change directions unless the turbulence leads us to our own death? That's the truth we got to tell. That's the courage we've got to muster. And that's the beauty of soul we must reveal to one another in the quietness of our own individual lives. Thank you so very much.
Michael Eric Dyson on Democracy Now!